Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm your host, Yaakov Katz, and you can find us on our website as well as on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We're less than a week out of elections, and the situation seems to be down to the wire. Israel goes to the polls on March 23rd for the fourth time in 2 years. It's incredible. Israel today leads the world in the pace of countries going to elections. Basically, countries that have political instability. Not exactly something that we should be shopping nachas from, being proud of. What happens next is anyone's guess at this point. Who will and who won't cross the threshold? Who will get the mandate to form a coalition from President Rivlin? And how exactly will this new coalition look like if one is even formed? One person who's been there since this whole mess started and actually tried to shake it up a bit is Asaf Zamir. He joined Blue and White way back when in 2019, entered the Knesset, ran in the additional two elections, joined the unity government as tourism minister, quit when Netanyahu violated the coalition deal, tried to get his party leader Benny Gantz to take a tougher stance with Netanyahu, and then was one of the so-called blue and white rebels who prevented a vote that could have stopped the government from collapsing. Despite a number of offers from other parties, Zamir decided to sit this upcoming election out and is instead, well, I'll leave it to him to tell us. To finish us off, I spoke with Jeremy Sharon, our religious affairs correspondent. We chatted a bit about matters of religion and state in Israel, the Haredi ultra-Orthodox standoff with the government, what COVID-19 taught us about the insular community, and whether things will ever change in a new coalition. Here we go. I'm now pleased to welcome Jeremy Sharon, the Jerusalem Post, a long time, about 10 years, has been our religious affairs correspondent. Jeremy, great to have you here on the podcast. First time, I think, right, on the podcast?
Yep, first time.
That's great. I have this feeling for a long time now, especially over the last couple of years, that Israel is really in this almost, I don't want to necessarily say it's a religious war, but there's a battle. There's a battle that's going on between certain parts of Israeli society that are pushing for more democratic, liberal democracy, and there are parts of Israeli society that are pushing for more religious intervention, primarily, obviously, the ultra-Orthodox. We saw that with COVID. We see that play out on the streets, not far from the office that we're sitting in right now, right, where they like to always protest and block the main junction near here whenever they want to protest about the IDF draft or something else. Do you share that sentiment, or is it just me? And do you think that this is ever going to change, right? Is there a way to rebalance what's happening here in the country?
So there's definitely an increased struggle in recent years between those who want greater influence for Judaism and for religion in the country and against those who want a more liberal, progressive society, more open and tolerant. And I think it's developed as parts of the general population have become more liberal over the years, and the old traditional way of doing things and the old certainties and trust in the Orthodox establishment has been eroded, and that erosion has happened for several reasons. But the upshot is that there is a growing sentiment that people want a more diverse expression of Jewish life and of Jewish practice, and a greater and growing rejection of the control of the Orthodox and increasingly ultra-Orthodox establishment, which has in recent years, concurrent with that growing liberalization of the general population, sought to increase its control and monopolies. So you've got those kind of two opposing forces which have clashed to a greater degree over the last decade.
And you're basically sharing some optimism, right? You think that the trend looks good for people who favor more freedom when it comes to religion in Israel.
I'm not sure I am optimistic because one of the great problems is that despite there is that sentiment that people want more openness and more general liberal attitude, the priority they put on that issue is not particularly high. So when it comes to voting, you see in polls, even on the right wing, Likud voters and other right-wing voters often agree that there should be civil marriage and public transport and Shabbat and so on, but they don't prioritize those issues, and they vote for the parties who will join the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox parties who are maintaining that religious control.
Bibi could eat bacon on Yom Kippur in Shul, and people would still vote for him.
Yeah, I guess so. That might be going a bit far, but I think there is, you know, Bibi is not a religious man by any sense. He doesn't eat kosher. He's had several.
The opposite. He's known to, when he travels overseas, he's known to go to the most, you know, seafood restaurants and,
exactly,
you know, eat whatever is in the Bible you're not supposed to eat.
100%.
But he doesn't pay a price for that. From the religious constituents vote for him. The religious parties support him blindly.
Exactly. Yeah. Because when it comes to their issues, he supports them blindly. And that's the compact that they've made.
So that's what I do want to hear a little more about that. So, their issues, right? I mean, you know, one that played out very blatantly just in the past couple of weeks was obviously the conversion and the High Court's decision to allow Reform and conservative conversions in Israel and for them to be recognized for the purpose of citizenship under the law of return. The Yadut HaTorah, United Torah Judaism Party, hitting back with that abhorrent video, in my opinion, of comparing Reform Jews to dogs, the bark mitzvah video. But we also know that throughout COVID, and Netanyahu has protected that, right? He's let that situation stay. He did not ever build the egalitarian plaza at the Western Wall, at the Kotel, as he had promised to, because of Haredi opposition. And we know, I think at least, and tell me, give me your thoughts, throughout COVID, there wasn't equal enforcement, right? We saw tens of thousands of people, Haredim, at funerals for people who had died from COVID, right? And police were nowhere to be seen, as opposed to other events that took place in more secular areas that police did come to break them up. So is that part of that Bibi worrying, caring, as you said, how do you say it, caring for their issues?
Yeah, I think the two issues are different, but it is the lack of enforcement is definitely connected to Netanyahu's political weakness and his dependence on his ultra-Orthodox allies. We saw a massive battle to increase fines against educational institutions who don't who open in contravention of the coronavirus regulations, and the ultra Orthodox went to war against that effort to increase those fines because they knew their institutions, which were opening against the regulations, would get fined.
And we saw, by the way, Jeremy, fines were given out so much more, or many more, in Tel Aviv and in Bnei Brak in Jerusalem, where he knew that schools were opening.
Absolutely.
And violation of regulations, no fines.
Absolutely. And then the other issue was the push to have differential lockdowns, which would have affected the ultra-Orthodox cities more. And the ultra-Orthodox politicians battled against that. And they won. And we had nationwide lockdowns as opposed to differential lockdowns.
Now, you Jeremy, went to, during Corona, when people were supposed to be locked down, there were a number of times that you actually went out to the streets all bundled up with the gloves and the masks
double
and whatever.
Double masks.
And you went to some of these Haredi neighborhoods here in Jerusalem. You even had one incident. Tell us a little about it, where you were assaulted by some Hasidim.
Yeah, so that was over last Sukkot. And it was widely known that the Bels Hasidim were one of the earliest and greatest violators of the coronavirus regulations. The Bels Hasidic Grand Rabbi decided that this wasn't a problem and he was just going to carry on as usual. And so over the Chol HaMoed Sukkot, the intermediate days of Sukkot, there's massive prayer services. And I
parties
thought,
also
parties absolutely and I thought I'd go and I'd go and find out what's happening one morning for the prayer services, and I stood outside the center.
And just so I can, for those of you listening, Jeremy does not look like a Bels Chassid, right? So you don't have the beard, he doesn't have the peyote,
there's stockings,
no, right? You don't wear the shoes and the white stockings, and you don't have the hat. So you definitely, I'm guessing, stood out there.
I definitely stood out. I stood back and tried to be as inconspicuous as I could for about half an hour, and I watched like every minute several dozen men walking towards the center. So over half an hour, hundreds of men, you know, walking into this center, which is completely in violation of the regulations. A mass prayer indoors, which, you know, every day, every prayer service, three times a day, was a mass spreader event. And I tried to get some video footage, because they were incredibly careful not to allow anyone in with phones to take pictures or videos. And I wanted to go and see if I could find anything, and I tried to get in several times. I was rebuffed. And the final time, I spent, lacking any footage, I wanted to take some footage of what I could see. So I started taking some videos and photos of those people walking into the center, which I couldn't get into. And at that point, I was assaulted. People tried to one person punched me in the chest. Another person tried to grab my phone. Another couple of guys tried to block me from leaving. And I mean, I fled as fast as I could. I was, you know, really shaken up right. When I got back to my car.
No, I can imagine. And the question, though, that I wonder sometimes is I look at the balance of power in Israel, right? And the Haredim, who make up today 10%, 12% of the population, right? So that's, you know, almost, let's say, about a million, 1.1, 1.2, depending who you ask. Obviously, high fertility rate, birth rate. But their numbers are growing, but their influence over Israeli society is tremendous, right? In terms of any matter of religion and state, the fact that Israel still doesn't have civil marriage, this issue of reform of conservative conversions, which was stuck in the court for 15 years, the court had said to the Knesset, legislate, pass a law. We don't want to get involved, but 15 years, it just dragged on and on, and the court made its decision. How does this change, or does it never change because of the political makeup of our system and how you always will need Haredim in the government, and as a result, you're going to have to pay the political price to get them?
It's very difficult to see now how it might this kind of logjam might be broken, but I think it does, to an extent. There is at some point going to be a critical mass of people who do prioritize this, who are affected by this, and I think beyond the religion and state issues, which don't have a huge priority in the public consciousness, the issue of what we've been talking about in terms of the coronavirus crisis, where the Haredi communities, the ultra-Orthodox community, has been set apart and almost a state within a state, which is something we've talked about a lot. I think that ultimately is going to be seen as a real existential danger in the future, when in 2065, 40% of Jewish Israelis are going to be ultra-Orthodox. And I think at some point, politicians are going to start listening to what the public and to what experts on these issues are saying. And perhaps that coalition will be there not to attack the Haredim and not to challenge them in a full frontal way, because I don't think that's going to be effective, but to start urging a change in the way that the public, the state addresses them, the state deals with them, and to try and foster change so that there is greater efforts to integrate them and not just to appease them, which I think largely has been the policy of the last 10 years.
So just tell us quickly, what would they say in response to this conversation that you and I are having, right? That they are states within a state, that they do what they want, that they have this disproportionate power and influence. What's the Haredi narrative on this?
Well, the Haredi narrative is always, you know, you accuse us of extorting the government, but the settler parties do the same, and everyone wants a piece of the pie, and we're just doing what everyone else does. And they also see they also see, especially during the coronavirus times, they think that the general public has been hypocritical, that there's been, you know, the protests against Netanyahu carried on, and they say that if there's protests, then why can't there be prayer in synagogue? The narrative is, and it's also the kind of, they embrace like a multicultural model and say, our lifestyle is our business, and this is how we want to live, and there is no justification for interfering in our lifestyle, and it's often a kind of a very entrenched attitude that people want to convert us. I mean, just the other day, just yesterday, Rabbi Gershon Edelstein, one of the most senior leaders of the community, said, you know, there's incitement, and they want to make us non-religious, and they want to destroy Shabbat, so they kind of create a narrative where everyone
they're
is against
under
them.
Attack.
They're under attack,
right?
Yeah.
Which is, by the way, one of the best things to do to solidify control, is to always present this adversary on the other side so that you can retain
which is why that kind of vitriolic rhetoric that we see from people like Lieberman is not helpful, because that just plays into their hands, and Lieberman is
that emboldens
them. Lieberman is in their election campaign ads now, you know, don't let Lieberman have the last laugh, you know. So,
and while the court decision, I think, for at least, was the right one when it came to the conversions, to create equality and create some freedom of religion in Israel, that also gives them a raison d'etre, right? You need the Haredi parties to protect Judaism. That would be their narrative. So that helps them as well.
That's definitely the narrative as well in the election, that, you know, religion is under attack and talking about reform, destroying the Jewish people and so on. So that's definitely a part of their campaign.
Jeremy, great to have you on. We'll check back in with you after the election results and as the coalition starts to be formed, whether they're going to be part of it or not be part of it, which would be a dramatic change. And then we would be able to see whether some new development is on the horizon for Israel's balance of power in religion and state, which is, I think that you'll probably agree with me, is our issues that we cover and we care deeply about here at the Jerusalem Post. But, you don't read as much in the regular mainstream, I'd say, media as much about these issues.
Definitely. Right? We've definitely got to focus on that. And I think that's what our readers are interested in and something which is critical for the country going forward.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Jeremy. Asaf Zamir, welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you, Jacob. It's great to be here.
So tell me, what's it like after 2 years you were running in nonstop elections, 3 elections, as a matter of fact? What's it like now not being on a campaign, right? You decided you're not going to be running in this upcoming election. So what's it like for the first time, I think, in a long time for you? Because you were deputy mayor of Tel Aviv for a bunch of years. You've been in politics for a long time. It's got to be a strange quiet, no?
First of all, I've been campaigning for 3 years because I started counting around June 2018 when I decided to run for mayor against Ron Huldai. That was a big campaign. I was in the front of it. And after that, after losing that campaign and going national, I had 3 more campaigns with Blue and White, and then the Unity Government, the Ministry of Tourism, leaving that, resigning, and then voting against lengthening the life of this government and actually taking Israel to another election. Altogether, 3 years. So it's been pretty hectic. It's also been, the last year was the hardest of them all. I became a father for the first time, and COVID.
So if you weren't sleeping because of politics, you weren't sleeping because of your baby, right? So just no sleep at all.
No sleep at all. And, and jokes aside, I gained, I think, 40 pounds.
Wow.
During these 2 years. It's a strange quiet, and I'm starting to love it. I just came back from a 4-hour walk with my mom in the park. I loved it.
And when was the last time you were able to go on a 4-hour walk with your mother?
No, lately it's
before this. I'm guessing over the last 3 years there weren't a lot of opportunities.
Before this, I was younger. When you're young, you don't want to walk with your mother. It's not a thing you want to do. So now I have a lot of time. Actually, I'm still a member of Knesset. Just there is no Knesset. So there's most of the week, there's no reason to go up to Jerusalem for. And then I have a lot of free time. So if I'm not spending it talking to the young people, or yesterday I went up to Kibbutz Ramat HaShofet to talk with a group of Mechina about the elections. But it is a lot of free time. And I'm getting to know my daughter. And I'm cooking a lot. And I'm actually enjoying it. It's my first break since I was young. I'm loving it.
Okay, well, enjoy. And your daughter, if I recall correctly, has an interesting name. Asia, maybe, right? A combination of your name and your wife's name?
No. Her name is Asia. It's Asia, but I don't know if I like... Yeah, I don't know if in English if we'll call her Asia or Asia yet. But after we called her that, someone wrote online that it's a combination of our names. We never thought of that before. And after we thought about it, it looked pretty pathetic, but it was too late. You don't change your daughter's name because you found that out and it sounds pathetic, but we wouldn't do it for that reason.
Got it.
But it is a combination of her. It is.
It is also, so, there's the benefit. She can look back later on and say, wow, what did my parents do to me?
Exactly. She will anyhow.
She will anyhow, of course, like we all do with all our parents.
Exactly. Yes.
So Asaf, looking back at these last 2 years, right, it's been a roller coaster. There were two elections, no government. The third election led to this unity government, which you supported initially, right? And you came in as a tourism minister. And then that's where things started to change. So tell me about when this shift happened that prompted you ultimately in October to resign from the cabinet, to resign from the government.
That was a second shift. The first shift was from running three times a campaign that's goal, leading goal was to replace Netanyahu. The first shift was the understanding that I support the unity government. And that happened at the beginning of March, or around the beginning of March of last year. And I remember the exact day. I was in Tel Aviv, and it was the beginning of COVID. And I walked downstairs with my newborn baby and my wife, and we walked around the city. And I'm fourth generation Tel Avivian, and I worked in the municipality for 10 years, and I never saw a sight like that, where the whole city was closed down, and shop owners had to close shop, and no one knew what this virus was and where it was going to lead us to, and how the economy would be hit from it. And it was a real feeling of urgency, okay, mm-hmm. of chirum. And it was sad. And if you understand economics of a city, then you understand that these small shops and stores and restaurants and bars, they can't close indefinitely. They can't survive being closed for a month or 2 months or whatever. And I knew we were going into something huge. For me, it was no different in its urgency than a war. And right. wars are times where unity is extremely important. And I said to myself, we're going into this national crisis. No one knows how long it's going to be. Bibi Netanyahu is running it. And we are the opposition saying we won't sit with him because he's indicted and because he's corrupt and all kinds of reasons that I believed in. And even if you'd asked the general public at that time, they didn't want to hear about politics. They wanted to hear about COVID. And we were portrayed as people doing politics while Netanyahu was running this crisis.
So there was a need to join.
If we were to wake up and see that a battle or a war started on two of our borders, everyone would support a unity government. And I didn't see a big difference between COVID and between that and the need for unity. And I knew that there were going to be really big decisions that were needed to be made on a security level, on a health level, on an economic level. And you can't make that with a small government or a transition government or a government that half the people in the country don't feel represented by. And that is why I thought unity was important. I want to remind you that when I thought that, this was before blue and white kind of fell apart. If all of blue and white would have entered the unity government as I wanted to, I would never have become minister. I was too low down the line to be a minister. It only happened because it fell apart and just a few of us joined.
But I think a lot of the country, to an extent, agreed with you and felt that sentiment too, that now with this pandemic, which at least in the beginning stages was portrayed to the Israeli public as the worst plague. Remember, the prime minister said the worst plague since the Middle Ages. No one knew where we were going and what we were entering. And it made sense for Benny Gantz to make that decision at the time to break off and to enter the government for unity, for the purposes of combating a pandemic. But then something changed, right? There was the second shift. So what happened those months in that you realized either this was a mistake or it's not going anywhere?
Two things happened. The first thing is I got to know Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, the way he works, the way his cabinet works. And I understood in the very early stage that he is not a partner in any way, that the good of the general good of the people is not. I said on an interview, it interests him on a best case scenario. It's the second most interesting thing he deals with, the people and their needs, after his politics and his legal status and, you know, making sure he stays in power. And you can't. And I understood in a very early stage that he's not going to stand up to all of his promises to us. That's number one. The second thing is that in light of that understanding, blue and white didn't do their politics the way you should with a person like that. And a series of decisions that we either didn't oppose or that we agreed to were decisions that were the wrong decisions for Israel. I think there was a belief behind them that if we do, promote good partnership with him, then at the end it will become a partnership. He didn't mean to at any stage. And there were certain days I can go back to, certain decisions made that it was very clear that were political decisions we should have opposed to, and we didn't. For example, okay, every time there was a lockdown, there were specific organizations that opened their gates even though they were supposed to be closed, and they were almost always in the Haredi sector, which was a very important sector politically for Netanyahu. And it was clear that the only way to deal with that was to create enlarged fines for these organizations. And every time we tried to bring enlarged fines to the table, Netanyahu disagreed to move him forward. And the fact that we let him every time really hurt the belief of the general people in our government. That's an example. There was one day at the beginning of the government where the budget committee dealt a whole day with Bibi Netanyahu's personal tax issues. Do you remember that?
He wanted a million shekel refund or something, right?
Yeah. That was a day where we should have got up and said, never. We don't agree. Not now. It's not the time to deal with that. And we didn't do that. And I think that hurt us as well. I think that at the beginning, when we tried to open up, when we tried to promote a smaller cabinet, and Netanyahu said, I need to have 36 ministers. There's a time where we could have said, it's not acceptable.
So what was it that led to the situation, though? Was it this feeling by members of your party, particularly by the leader, Gantz, that you don't want to push the lines, the limits, you don't want it to break, we want to try to get along, and not realizing that Netanyahu plays politics at a whole different level?
Yeah, it's that. Mm-hmm. It's that, and sometimes when you're in the room with him and he tries to explain to you why something extremely unpopular is needed, he's very persuasive at that point, right? I think it's a lot of lack of nisayon, of lack of
experience.
Of experience, yeah. I think it's lack of experience, political experience by Blue and White, by Benny Gantz, by his people at the beginning of the way. By the way, you can see it now. Now that they're campaigning and they have a bit more experience, they're using their political power against Netanyahu in a way, in a series of decisions in the Corona cabinet and other places, that if they use this from the get-go, would be perceived differently and better by the people, I believe. Because you can be in Israel, evidentially, sadly, you can be a thief and a liar and whatnot, and people will vote for you. But if you're soft, people won't vote for you. And when you're up against Netanyahu, you can't show that you're soft.
What does that say about Israel? What does that say about the Israeli electorate, the public? Why do we vote that way?
I think it's a very... Okay. Israel's politics are very different, for example, than American politics. It's a very tribal country. People vote by their identity, by the place they live, by their religion, by their level of belief, by their history, their family's history. They vote against
their ethnicity.
People they hate. They vote against people they hate more than they vote for the people they vote for. Okay, and it's a very violent, very aggressive atmosphere. And in this aggressive atmosphere, people appreciate aggression and don't appreciate weakness. Is it a good thing? No, it's a bad thing.
Can it be changed?
I'm not sure.
Be optimistic, Asaf. Come on, give us optimism.
I don't need to be optimistic. I'm not up for any role. I don't want you to vote for me. I can be, for the first time in many years, I can be truly sincere. But my sincerism is that I'm not very optimistic.
Do you think that, so if we look at these elections, and they're a week away, a little less, what outcome do you foresee? Can you give us a prediction?
I think it's the closest to call, too close to call, more than any election I've covered or took part in, because the small parties that will or will not pass the threshold on both sides, there are now four parties that are in extreme danger, okay? And you don't know if they'll withdraw, if they'll run till the end, if they'll pass. By the way, one of them, you don't know on what side he is, which is Ram. And also, right. because
that's the Israeli Arab Party, right?
That's one of the Israeli
Arab
Party. It's a, the small one. There's a joint list, and then there's Ram.
Correct.
And they have an alliance with Netanyahu, even though we usually put Arab representatives on the left side of the political map in Israel. It's different with them. So we don't know how we don't know how they'll vote. We don't know who's going to pass the threshold. And the other thing is that there is no right now at this specific point of time, and for different geopolitical demographic reasons, there is no Israeli right wing. And I'll explain. Okay, the right wing in Israel is divided twice. First thing it's divided about for maybe the first time ever is that inside the right wing there is a yes Bibi no Bibi camp. Okay, there are parties in the right wing that only only exist because Netanyahu still is in power. So New Hope by Gideon Sar is a party that has no right of existence the day after Netanyahu. By the way, now that Yamina, Naftali Bennett's Yamina, it lost Smotrich and the national religious group, they're also a right-wing party that will not exist the day Netanyahu will not be in power because they don't have. There's no ideological difference anymore. So that's the first thing. The only difference between Gideon Sar and Naftali Bennett is Gideon Sar says, I will never sit with Bibi, and Naftali Bennett says, I'll do what's best for me the day after the elections. I'm not promising you anything. The second way the right wing is divided and used to not be divided like that is there is a very, very ultra-religious right wing, but there's also a very, very ultra-secular right wing. That didn't exist either before. So Israel Beitenu, Avigdor Lieberman's party, which is broadly immigrant and Russian and Olim party, has in the last three elections has a very ultra-secular separation of church and state platform that you can't count together in the same body with Shas, for example. So lots of people are going to vote next Tuesday without understanding which coalition their vote will go to. For that reason also, it's really very too close to call. If you look at the maps or the last exit polls, or the last polls in the last 2 weeks, then there's a bigger chance. This is my belief, okay? If everything goes as planned, there's a bigger chance that a month from now there'll be a new prime minister that's not Bibi.
Interesting. So tell me, before you resigned from the government, right, you were, until October, you were the Minister of Tourism. And just quickly, you know, tourism obviously has been hit, maybe the hardest industry, right, in under COVID or across the world. We don't let, you know, tourists into Israel, hotels, all tour guys, the whole industry just decimated. Now that we're opening up, and I know you're not there right now, but do you think that we're on the right track? Do you, because we probably have a lot of people listening to us from around the world who want to come visit Israel. Is there a light at the end of that tunnel? Do you think that we might be close to allowing tourists back into Israel?
I think we're going to be one of the first big major countries allowing tourists back in because of the vaccines and because we're way ahead of many countries, and we understand the importance to it. Look, the tourism industry in Israel is a beautiful industry. Its problem is that it's a small industry. It calculates to 2.5% of Israel's GDP. The Greek tourism industry calculates to 24% of Greece's GDP. So they will go to a farther length to make sure that goes back. In Israel, they don't want to take a chance and say, we're not opening an industry that will bring in 2.4% and make and bring in more COVID,
right?
Until we're pretty sure it's open. But two good things happened this year. The first thing is the vaccines that I talked about. The second thing is that out of lack of choice, hundreds of thousands of Israelis that used to only tour abroad vacationed in Israel this year.
Right,
and kind of discovered Israel.
I was in Eilat for the first time in years, as an example.
I love Eilat. How was Eilat to you?
It was great, but I hadn't, again, just because of exactly what you said, I had not been to a lot for years, because when we would go on vacation, it's usually overseas, without a doubt.
But
yeah.
But now answer honestly, was your visit to a lot good enough that you might visit there again, even after the skies will open?
Without a doubt. Yeah.
See, so that's, first of all, I'm very happy. That's a great thing that happened. And I think the potential there is big. Another big place, but that needs a big reform, is what we call agro-turismo. Israel is developing. It has a beautiful desert. It has a beautiful north. And it has a very, very big scene of agricultural tourism, or what we call in Hebrew, tzimirim. It's bed and breakfasts. Mm-hmm. And that is a potential that I think could be very, very big. If Israel becomes a place that is considered safer for COVID than other countries, for example, Europe, and people would come here and tour Israel, that would create something that I think, as former Minister of Tourism, is needed, which is regulation over this sector, because it's a very expensive sector, whereas in the rest of the world, it's usually cheaper. And it only gives certain levels of hospitality and not a broad enough variety. But I think the potential there to grow
Interesting.
Is very, very big.
Interesting.
The last thing people need to remember about tourism, it is the first industry that closed down. It is the last industry that will open. So it's going to need help from the government, which I was actually constructive in creating that kind of packages of funds to assist the tourism infrastructure. The last thing is that for many years, the Israeli tourism was based on three kinds of tourists: the Israeli citizen, the Jewry from around the world, but mostly American Jews, and evangelists, American Christians coming here for religious reasons. And right. All of these three groups are kind of what you call captive audiences in a way, okay? And because they've been captive audiences, we haven't invested enough and a high enough level of planning and funds in infrastructure for tourists. And you kind of, you know, Elat, I didn't ask you for any reason. I asked you for a specific reason. And this is this following question. Elat is not good enough to compete with its other Elats in the world. Okay. And Tiberias needs massive work in order to be, to fit its full potential. And public transportation for tourists to farther places around the country is very far from the point it could be.
Right.
So there's still a lot of work to do, but I believe that this industry will bounce back and grow.
Okay, we hope. So I also, you know, people are probably listening and they're wondering, Asaf Zamir, we know him as a politician, but he's got perfect English, right? So you and I spoke, we met, and what I didn't know as well, right, is that your mother is originally from the United States, I think Chicago, if I recall correctly. Grew up okay. And you actually spent a few years in Florida as a child, right? Back in the great 1980s, even though you were born in Tel Aviv. So you actually had U.S. citizenship, which you then, upon becoming a Chaver Knesset, a member of Knesset, like all members of Knesset, you have to revoke or give up or whatever it is. But when you look at the relationship that Israel has today with Jews around the world, particularly the American Jewish community, do you think that we do enough as a country? Is the government doing enough to engage with diaspora Jewry?
I think it's a hard question. I think for sure the government's not doing enough, but I'll go to a length of saying that it's the last 10 years. It's not that they haven't done enough. It's that they've brought real damage for inner political reasons to the relationship. It's the same thing exactly as the end of bipartisanship towards Israel because of Netanyahu's policy in the last 10 years and him actively taking a role in American presidential campaigns. First PM to ever do that, to the best of my knowledge, and kind of ruining the bipartisanship, which I thought was strategically extremely important for Israel. The relationship with democratic Jews, the relationship with the reform movement, the relationship with the conservative movement, questions about who is a Jew, which are looked differently in Israel and differently in the United States, have made have distanced many American Jews from Israel. The second thing is that a lot of American Jews see the policies taken by the Israeli government as the wrong policies. Now, it's a totally different question. Do American Jews have the right to have an opinion and to be mad because they don't live here? That's a whole, we can do a whole another podcast about that. But at the end of the day, that's the result. The result is that lots of them feel that they're not as connected to Israel. And the worst part about it is the second generation. The children of these people are growing up without feeling any relation or special relation to Israel. And these people are the next generation lobbyists for Israel. They are the next generation AIPAC. They are the next generation J Street. They are the next generation of newspapers and of Hollywood. And if they don't feel that Israel is important, that its existence is important, that their relationship with it is important, and if they don't feel that Israel looks at them and understands their contribution, then we're going to lose a very, very strong asset. And that's sad, also on a strategic level, but also on a spiritual level, on an emotional level.
And can it be fixed? Is it too late, or in your assessment, it can be repaired?
No. I think it can be repaired. I think politics repair everything. Things need to change. But, I know people that lived in the States and felt for the last 4 years under Donald Trump that he doesn't represent them and that it's not the United States that they knew of. And it took 2 days with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and one picture of all-star shoes and one tweet, and they feel home again. And obviously the opposite. Obviously the opposite. Politics change, and I think a more moderate government in Israel, I think the days after Netanyahu, I think a democratic president, which won't make the bipartisanship worse. I think all of these things can make a difference, but Israel needs to work in that difference. It needs to allocate funds to make sure it works with the organizations and it works with Hillel and Birthright and lots of organizations that are doing extremely important work in maintaining this relationship, even through tough times. But yeah, it's reversible and it's fixable.
So just finally, if politics do fix everything, are you kind of now is this just a hiatus, just a short break for politics for you? Or are we going to see you back at some point? What's next for Asaf Zamir?
First of all, I love the word hiatus because for many years as a child, I didn't know what it meant. I heard it in the movie once and it sounded like a coyote. I didn't understand. I haven't decided yet. I mean, I didn't want to leave. I think that there were nisibot.
Circumstances.
The circumstances changed, and if you look openly at a political situation, you need to know when it's time to take a break for a second. I think after this year, it wasn't personal. Just this year was a horrible year for politics. It was a horrible year for my side of politics. Lots of people lost faith. I think we were part of the reason they lost faith. And I felt uncomfortable jumping to a new election, jumping over to a new party and saying, it's about me and vote me in. And I needed to get out for a second and breathe and see how it looks from outside and see what it does to me. But I have always in my life been very involved in things happening in Israel, in social issues, in political issues, and I don't see a situation in which I won't be, I won't contribute anywhere I can. Will I return? I'm not saying no. I'm just not thinking about it right now. Right now, I'm walking the park with my mom, as they say.
Enjoy those walks, Asaf.
Thank
you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.